Getting here. My name is David Wildman, and the session tonight is Yellow Ribbons to Yellow Journalism, the Media and the Gulf War. And we're not, by the way, seeing a slide. Slides. We're going to have oral media only, and maybe some stuff on the board. But in trying to think of how to approach this, the media, as I think everyone's realized with this war, has played a major, major role. That's certainly true, I think, with a lot of wars of the 20th century, that more and more the media came to be a significant portion. And so this evening, I'd like to sort of focus on that role of the media. What role did the media play? What experiences did we have of it? And move towards not only evaluating that role, but saying, what is it we want and expect from the media? And if it failed in that task, which I think probably many folks felt it did, one way or another, how might we improve that in the future so that the media can be more accountable to us and more really a tool that we can use? So with that, I'm going to start with a series of questions just to get a sense of our own use of the media, since with many other topics, you have someone who's, when you talk about war and peace, there are certain folks who've served in war, so they have an immediate experience that other people don't. With the media, my guess is every single person in the room is on some level an expert, or at least a consumer of a major sort. And so I'd just like to check, in terms of getting your news, how many folks would say you get your primary news from television? Okay, there's no right or wrong answers here. This is just...
Take up an international or
whatever news, just news, your primary news. And you can, if you feel you want to vote more than once, that's okay too. how many get your primary news from radio?
Public
radio. Okay. And how about primary news from newspapers? Okay, that seems to be the majority in this group. And how about magazines or other printed media? Okay, I'm sure we all use a variety. It's not like you only, is there anybody who doesn't watch TV at all? All right, we got a few folks. Yeah, in Holden, if you live in Holden, that's, there's a limited number of equipment. But there's an interesting study which I want to start with on the Gulf War that was done by the University of Massachusetts. And they checked these sorts of questions. What do you watch TV? How much do you watch? Do you listen to radio, etc.? And then they asked people questions about the war. What was going on? Who were we fighting? What was, different things like that. Was Kuwait a democracy or not? Was Iraq a democracy? I mean, they had a range of questions. And what they discovered was that the more television that you watched as your primary source of news, the less that you knew about the Middle East, and the more likely you were to support the war. The less television you watched, the more you, percentage-wise, chances are you knew more about the Middle East, and it was more likely you were critical or ambivalent or uncertain about the war than supportive of the war, which to me is an interesting notion. Now, one conclusion from that is that the American public, obviously not us, but everyone else, watches TV and they're ignorant and we're well informed. And yet, when they ask questions of identifying the major missile systems and military hardware that was used in the Gulf War, the people that watch TV could name a Patriot, describe what it does, could name an M1A1 tank, could name a Apache attack helicopter and on down the list, and they knew what each one did. So there was a high degree of knowledge from any of the media. So the question was not that by watching TV it means you're stupid or you become stupid, but that you're misinformed. And that's the key point, is that it's not that watching TV somehow you don't get, that dulls your mind or something like that. That was not the point of the study, but that the media itself was misrepresenting and in many cases providing factually wrong material, particularly the television. Many people thought Kuwait, more people who watched TV thought Kuwait was a democracy. And there's a number of other, you know, questions like that.
So there were people on television stating that Kuwait was a democracy, or are these people never talked?
Not exactly, but the suggestions, there were actually factually wrong stuff. I don't know about that specific instance, but I do know that, you know, in terms of illusions and, you know, when you suggest we're fighting for democracy and we're fighting to liberate Kuwait, what does that suggest? I mean, so it was not technically someone saying Kuwait is a democracy, but when you put two, you know, sort of two things next to one another, an intelligent person concludes there's some connections there.
Well, television is primarily an entertainment medium, more so than any of the others. And even their bias on the news is that way, because they worry about ratings more than what they're putting forth.
I thought also, weren't they extremely worried about one network scooping the other? And a lot of it, I know a lot of the misinformation that we got was simply racing to beat somebody else with some important piece. And a lot of it went wrong.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll see if that's...
we'll see, okay.
I'm not sure that's the case, actually. Okay. But they were all equally bad. And what I'm, in my opinion, this is not, you're not getting an objective sense here. I'll say that I watched an awful lot of TV the first few weeks, and then finally just decided I was seeing the same thing over and over and over again, and so I stopped watching. But I'd like us to take, what I'd like to do today with that sort of, you know, sort of introduction about the range of media, and not to suggest, you know, there's all sorts of questions one can do about printed media as well, newspapers and how they covered things, as well as radio, and different stations. That I want to talk about a couple key issues that I think are really important, and then also have us discuss what is the role that media plays and what do we want it to play. The issues that I'd like to raise, which I've seen as under the media as some of the major issues to address with the war, and feel free to add to this list. It's not by any means exhaustive, but
Could you talk
a little bit
of color up there?
Oh, okay, yeah.
There's another set of lights, too.
Oh, is there another set of
lights? Yeah,
there,
another kind.
That would help.
Oh,
well, the switch is back there.
The switch is behind the back.
Okay, let me see. How about this
black
is black?
Be, black should be a lot better.
Yeah,
is that better?
Yeah.
Okay.
Green's tough.
Glare from
yeah. Censorship, that was an issue that came up.
No, the police shot is over by the door.
There we go. Is that better? There's also an issue of reporters' access. Then another one was experts. We all sat and listened to one expert after another, and the question is, who are the experts, and how is it that they're defined as experts, and what expertise? So each of these has a lot of questions. Are there other things, folks, issues people would like to address that, or think are major issues around the media that?
Well, one that comes up particularly in television is there's got to be whatever it is, 10 minutes worth of news each day, whether there's nothing or everything in the world is happening.
Right, so it's a set format. Do you know, on a half-hour program of nightly news, how much program time there is?
What,
22 minutes and 8 minutes of commercials. There's a radio station in New York that says, if you give us 22 minutes, we'll give you the world. So there's a format, and if you, you know, factor in, you got to have a human interest story, you got to have introductions and sort of, you know, transitions. This 22 minutes is sort of around the same length as many people's sermons that you hear on a Sunday morning. It's also about less news than is on the front page of a daily like the New York Times or Washington Post or, you know, one of the fold-out ones, not the tabloids. And it's about 5 to 8 pages double-spaced. So if you want to figure, you know, if you're reading that, to get a sense of just how much information we're getting. Other issues?
How about repetition? Because if they say the same thing the first of every hour.
Mm-hmm. So particularly on the radio, and then if there's...
CNN was doing that too.
Mm-hmm. Okay, other issues that folks...
Distortion,
okay. Yeah, that's... And some...
Yeah, I think it fits the same category. Like part of language, like euphemism. For instance, the media quit using body bags and used like human remains or purses instead. Because it sounds less threatening or less dead.
Right. Well, the key word was, remember, the collateral damage.
Collateral damage?
Yeah, that was human life being taken. As opposed to real damage, which was tanks and... So that's one example. I mean, there's many others. Smart bombs as opposed to dumb bombs. other issues, concerns?
There's never a perspective from any other country in the world. Ever.
Yeah. And how do we put that? No.
U.S. perspective only.
Yeah. Narrow. Huh?
Right. We could say ethnocentric or put U.S. only.
Self-centered.
Or egocentric.
U.S.-centric, yeah. U.S.-centric. Yeah. How many folks during the Gulf War are right, just on that question there, read any or got any international news from other countries? So a few people. Yes.
Uh-huh. What this U.S.-only perspective? I didn't see it, but I was under the impression that the U.S. media aired a rather long-winded speech by Saddam Hussein sometime during the whole period.
Yes, there was a speech, which was part of this. Hussein invited Bush to
speak to
the Iraqi people, if in turn he could speak to the American people. So they did that. I don't remember the exact length, but it was long.
9 hours.
Hussein is a very long-winded fellow. So his speeches are never short. But other concerns or issues?
For television, there's parameters that they have to work with, and because it's a visual medium, they can't just sit there and show a person talk. Well, CNN did a lot of that, but they have to have a lot of visual stuff, and that comes in with the tanks and all that, what they're showing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that gets to this, the format thing. There's also a whole, particularly with the visual, the same thing in newspapers. I don't know if you watch the layout and the way photographs are used next to stories. The New York Times, which is my sort of, it's the paper I hate to read every day, is very interesting in terms of it's notorious for putting a photograph of one story right next to a totally unrelated story, and yet there's a message there. And so there's ways in which other medium do that as well, except for radio. I got a couple more.
How about, and here's one that really bothers me, is the trivialization of events. I mean, they say, we're bringing in this mass murderer, and he's raped all these people, and he's done this and that, and we'll give that news just after this message. I mean, what does that tell you? I mean, what message does that convey?
That commercial.
That isn't really that important that he did these things. That's what it conveys to me.
The same thing with the war.
Well, that someone mentioned earlier, which they didn't put down here, is the whole entertainment aspect.
That's the horse that left the commercials.
And someone just said sports. There was it was a little unclear whether world news became sporting news or vice versa, but sports metaphors reign supreme, and I'll just put sports metaphors. Okay, anything back there, Mary.
It was very disturbing that the Corps had a theme song or maybe several that they composed in music to introduce every news spot on the major network.
Mm-hmm. And new theme songs? Okay.
Giving it a kind of validity, like the Olympics or something, you have some theme song that ties into the entertainment value.
Yeah. They also, ABC, I think it was the one that constructed a whole set of the sandbox with the map of the Gulf that Peter Jennings and other experts could walk around on. We have to point out that, I mean, if it isn't for the fact that it's dealing about a life and death situation, there are some really comic things about the media in their efforts to sort of keep people's attention as you're making dinner or, you know, doing whatever else you're doing while the set is on.
Another thing is, in general, the media's complete disregard for background on a particular issue is very immediate, and there's very little in the way of education or history about,
how much history can one give? And if anyone sat in on John Avery sessions of giving more about the Middle East and some of the diversity of the region, there's an absence of history and context that there might be reasons for things going on. Okay, well, are there any others briefly? Or I'm sure there's more, and in some sense I think we could, you know, focusing on the Gulf War and the way the media covered it or didn't cover it, just a second, okay, really leads us into examining the media itself. And so I hope we don't feel constrained, but, you know, think of how important media is in the lives of people in this society, which is different than it was 50 years ago in this society, and is different than many other societies. Yes, I don't want to cut you off.
I would like to be enlightened. It seems to me that after we quote unquote won the war, it would seem a great irony that CNA could be in Iraq during the war, reporting every little thing. I haven't seen any of the devastation really covered at length as the aftermath of what we did to win the war. Maybe I just got saturated and couldn't watch anymore, but has that really been explored or exposed to the extent that it was beforehand?
A little bit. Yeah, it's coming out now. And there are one report after another, at least in the printed media.
Is Iraq allowing it?
What?
Is Iraq allowing anybody to really tell the story about what happened?
Iraq's not really in a position to, I mean, yes and no. I mean, they're allowing a lot more than they did during the war. Greenpeace has some estimates on casualties. There have been a variety of witness for peace groups and other types of journalist groups that have gone to Iraq for, as well as Kuwait in some instances, for anywhere from a week to 3 weeks, documenting as much as one can. What's happened in March, the United Nations had a study team that went to both Iraq and then to Kuwait that issued a report, which was just extraordinary in its the form of devastation. And almost every single report since then has confirmed more or less the same, including the Pentagon's Defense and Intelligence Agency has come out with estimates of casualties.
So why is that not more readily available to the average person who doesn't go and seek it out? nobody wants to hear it.
That's a good, I mean, that's a good question is, what is it, and this gets to what I'd like to ask now is for folks to think is, what is it that we expect out of media? What is it that we as a society want out of media? And think about that for a moment. And that maybe we can get some answers here. What I'd like to do is before we get to that question, but see that as sort of where we're going, is spell out a few of these things and give some stories, because I think I found that hearing certain stories of actually media coverage is some amazing stuff. Did people hear a lot about censorship? And what forms of censorship were there? Who was doing the censoring?
U.S.
military. It was the U.S. military, and then Iraq was doing, Peter Arnett was the one person apparently being, you know, that was his image of this lone journalist hanging out in Baghdad.
I think possibly corporations or sponsors were censoring someone. Right, in the, and possibly in the newspapers also, if they would have had a large, mm-hmm. But I think corporations had something to do with censorship.
We should put corporate sponsors here somewhere in the issues. I want to suggest that two things were going on, and what Bob suggested here is a form of self-censorship by the media itself, in addition to the actual censorship of, say, the Pentagon or other military officials. Every war, there's been some form of censorship, you know, needing to keep military secrets, and the military needing to check reports from different reporters and what they're doing. So that was not new, the level of censorship and control of the media in the Gulf War probably was greater than any other war, even though technology is ostensibly, you know, much more sophisticated, so you could have greater access. The censorship was much greater. And the access question, which is related to this, is for the first time, reporters could not, in other wars, reporters could basically go along with the unit and go where the unit went. And then the censorship came when they're writing their report to be aired back home. Somebody would check in on that. But now reporters could not travel anywhere without the military personnel accompanying them, whose specific role was to check what they were doing at every given moment, including being present when they interview someone. In the past, it was when they were writing up the interview that the censorship took place. And now you have this dynamic of, here's someone over your shoulder while you're interviewing somebody. What is that person going to, you know, what does that do to this sort of journalist and, you know, interaction in terms of the possibilities for interviews?
You. Well, I think we have this idea that journalists should be able to go anywhere they please. Mm-hmm. If you look at it from a military standpoint, they're babysitting these people, and they have to look out for their welfare. It's a danger. I mean, they hold them hostages, and that puts them in another situation. And also, I think that it'll take a long time before we know what happens. I think the Americans are impatient people. We expect immediate knowledge of everything that's going on. You can't do it all the time. When you see from one spot at one time, you might not know what's going on for a couple of months.
Okay, I think that's always, I mean, with any event like a war, there's a lot to get sorted out. We'll talk more about that.
One thing that's different is that in the past, by the time the information reached the public, it was somewhat old, mm-hmm. and it was not. A lot of times, the information was instantaneous.
This war, more than any other war, has been described as a media war. That the media, and an example of that is when Jesse Jackson, in last fall, went over to Iraq to try and arrange for some of the diplomats to be released and sent home. He said, I went into Baghdad and I went to some of the government officials, and they were watching CNN to see what was the latest word of what was happening. And when I went to the soldiers on the front, on both sides, the Iraqi soldiers and the American soldiers, they were both watching CNN. And when I went back to Washington, Jackson says, and I met with officials, they were always quoting to me CNN. And he said, I had this strange feeling that people were fighting a war and checking CNN first to figure out what was happening. And one other story related to that is the United Nations, ostensibly whom, you know, was the body that made the decision for this, though it was really a U.S. war, and I'm going to talk next week more as to some of the reasons about why I think that was the case. But the United Nations, the eve that the bombing started, was in session on some, the Security Council was meeting on some other issue. And then, you know, there was a recess and they sort of, the diplomats were trickling out, and a friend of mine is a journalist who was there in the press area. And all of a sudden, word started trickling out, you know, something's happening in Baghdad, there's, you know, something on CNN. I don't know what it is, but there's something going on. Well, all of the UN officials, from the press corps to the ambassadors, raced to offices that had CNN and watched on CNN a war unfolding that they had authorized. They didn't know any more than CNN. And so there's this interesting thing of where in past wars, past events besides war, there was a sense that the people were making history or leaders were making history and the media was somehow reporting that. Here were the leaders and decision makers turning to the media to find out what was going on. And it's an interesting sort of, you know, dynamic and switch. Not that the media was controlling, I mean, I'm not trying to suggest the media was shaping what was going on, but that people came to rely on media as a means of figuring out what was going on, even the ones in decision-making power, including George Bush and others. You know, he was portrayed as watching CNN and the various other networks to find out what was happening. He had his other sources as well, you know, in terms of intelligence, but the media really has become very central in this war, and the fact that it started in the midst of primetime nightly news on the East Coast, it was like 6:45 Eastern Standard Time, right in the midst of Peter Jennings and the CNN folks and others announcing stuff, all of a sudden it's like the bombing has started. And I want to suggest that was not an accident, that the media was such an important role in producing support within this country, as well as monitoring, and this gets to the self-censorship part. I want to say one word about that and then move to the experts, which is another big thing. In terms of self-censorship, NBC is owned by, does anybody know who owns? General Electric, which is probably one of the, if not the largest, one of the largest military contractors in the country. It makes most of the electronic components for the Patriot missile and every other single important weapon used, the Tomahawk cruise missiles, the helicopters, the tanks, all had GE components in them. Now, when NBC does a report on how well the weapons are working, that their company is beholden to, you know, what sort of, you know, objective journalism goes on? When that level of, you know, you're reporting on your boss's work, you're not going to do the same sort of coverage as if you're reporting on some other company. And that's where, that's just one sort of example of self-censorship, or the media deciding, well, this is not something the American people want to hear. And they don't want blood and gore, so we'll give them sort of a sanitized version of all this. This goes on an awful lot, and that's just one example. And the second is in experts here. There was a study done by a group called Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Has anybody heard? I'm going to erase some of this here. It's an excellent group, and I have their address. It's fairness
and accuracy in reporting are fair. And they have regularly, for a number news programs, because they're more in depth and stick to like one topic, or in McNeil Lair's, they do three topics in an hour and there's no commercials. So ostensibly these are the better news programs. Well, they did a study of the experts that come on, all the panelists, and let me just see. During the first, I gotta find this thing. Okay, out of 878 sources the networks used during the first 2 weeks of the war, only one source was a representative of a national peace movement. In another instance, they counted up the minutes of coverage. There was something like 2,855 minutes of coverage during a certain period of time at the beginning of the war. 29 minutes of that 2,855 were devoted to anti-war protests. So 1%. And then if you looked at the officials, it's something like 90% were government officials or former government officials, and that's U.S. government by and large, and almost all of them were male and white. And so, in some sense, this whole notion of, you know, on what we consider and some are considered some of the more in-depth news coverage is a very limited view of who is an expert. And that's where we can ask, you know, who's an expert on war? Who's an expert on what's happening in the Middle East? And maybe that's what needs to be challenged a lot. And I want to suggest that that's where turning to alternative sources and pushing them to try and broaden this out a little bit is really a crucial issue that needs to be taken on.
I think the so-called experts completely let us down basically on the military information. They had us believing that it was going to be a terribly long, hard ground war with a lot of people killed on the U.S. side, and it turned out to be a completely different kind of war. Did you think the military experts would have known?
Well, I think they did to some degree. In the Iran-Iraq war, 8 years, 1980 to 1988, a 500,000 to 1,000,000 people were killed between the two sides. It was a devastating war. During that entire 8 years, the Iraqi Air Force, the most powerful or largest air force in the Middle East, did not shoot down one single Iranian plane. Not a single plane in 8 years. They were fairly good at bombing civilian cities. They were good at bombing things on the ground, but they didn't shoot down a single plane. Well, if you're coming up against that air force with the United States Air Force, the most powerful air force in the world, and you're facing an air force that's never shot a plane out of the sky, what do you think is likely going to happen?
Hide the plane.
And what happened? You know, they sent a few up, but basically all the planes hid or left the country and went to Iran. And what we had was a war that, I mean, there's now reports that I've seen in the papers coming out that the satellite photos, which it's been very hard to get public access to, but some of the satellite photos from the fall show no massive troops on the Kuwaiti-Saudi border, in terms of Iraqi troops. There's no massive troops there. And so they're questioning whether there was even really the 500,000 or so Iraqi troops that were claimed to be in Kuwait there. And so there's an awful lot of things like this that, now some of that the Pentagon is responsible for in terms of what access the media has, you know, do they don't know that right away, it comes out months later or years later, as some you suggested back there. But some of that is available, it's publicly available. And the other story I want to give here and then open it up a little bit is the first week of February, Ramsey Clark, the former Attorney General, went with a film crew and a translator to Iraq. And in 5 days, he covered 2,000 miles all over the country. They went wherever they wanted to go. They were not at all restricted in their movement, except for, you know, somewhat concerned as to where the bombs were going. And they saw whatever, you know, they would basically look for explosions and then go to the site and interview people. And their point was to document civilian casualties and civilian damage, not military damage. So they did not seek out like military bases or anything like that, but just to document what effect the bombing was having on the civilian population of Iraq. And they got, you know, a lot of filmage. I've seen some of the film. It's available in a videotape. When they came back to the United States, they went to one network after another, and the first NBC, and they were all set, and Tom Brokaw was very excited, and suddenly they were informed that it was too controversial and could not be aired. So then they went to CBS, and at first they were very excited, and then in the process of editing it, they were told that the editor was fired and that they would have to get back to him as to whether they could use it or not. The long and short is, it wasn't until several months later that PBS, a select number of PBS stations ran even clips of the thing. But here was one of the only, if not the only, uncensored film footage from Iraq, which you would think if you're a media person, if you're like the president of a TV station, this is hot stuff. If you show uncensored material in the midst of a war where everything else on the news on every station is censored, this is a real scoop. And yet, not a single station wanted that sort of scoop. And you have to ask, why is that? That was not the Pentagon telling them, you know, what was going on. And that, I want to suggest, raises some questions about corporate sponsors in terms of what corporations, you know, who is it that the media is primarily interested in serving? Is it the people that are viewing, or is it the folks that pay their bills and, you know, the advertising?
Is it perhaps a factor of, aren't they going to ask, or be concerned about, what does the public really want to see? Mm-hmm. If they show something that offends the public, then that doesn't mean anything either. That's not a good reason.
Yeah. Well, who I'd like to ask now, and to try and sort of unearth, you know, we've got a few facts and some issues out here. But one thing is determining who is the public and who determines who that public is. And the third question is who determines what that public wants. I mean, where do we? In other words, where does that come from? Think about who is the public. Who? What would folks say?
I mean, generally speaking, you're related to TV.
Well, related to the media, let's put a little broader than just TV, because you know, in terms of when the media as a whole, newspapers as well, are talking about the public, who do they have in mind?
Their customers.
Their customers.
People who buy the products.
Upper middle class white people, for the most.
Who's going to spend the money?
Upper middle, okay. Who's going to spend the money? It's okay, we've got a number of different John and Jane public here. So we've got customers and white middle class. Is that, was that?
Yeah.
And someone else said something. What else do we have for the public?
Voters.
Voters.
How does that make sense, though, since the 98% of the homes in America have TVs? How can it just be white upper middle class?
Well, it's a question, that's a good question.
Well, that's the next question you asked. Who determines? And that's A.C. Nielsen or Roper.
What are the Roper or Nielsen polls determine?
What do they determine?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they're supposed to determine what people are thinking, but I'm not sure who they ask or how they get.
I
say
think
it's random.
They determine how much they can charge their sponsors for a minute.
Right. But what is it that Nielsen provides to the networks that then they can base their advertising rates on?
How many people are watching?
How many people are watching?
Out of the people that have a Nielsen box.
Right. But they generalize from that to the public. And that's the important thing is that in terms of...
So we say customers.
Yeah, customers. Well, what you could say is basically the media sells a product. And the product that they sell is not their programming, but a guaranteed number of viewers for a certain time segment. That's what they sell. And it's important for us to, you know, we often think of what they're selling us as the programming because that's what we're interested in. But what they sell to make their money as a corporation is a percentage of viewer share, you know, however you want to say it, but basically it's a guaranteed number of people that have a set on at that time. And that's what they're interested in. They want to make as many people have a set on their channel as possible.
Or subscriptions or...
Mm-hmm. And the same, the same thing with the circulation. In New York, there was a strike for the Daily News, and the paper kept coming out during the strike. But one advertiser after another stopped advertising because they said, look, you can't guarantee a certain rate of circulation. They didn't say, look, the quality of your news is really horrendous, and therefore we don't really want to put ads in your paper. What they said was your circulation is falling.
Aren't they also concerned about not only the number, but what type of people are watching?
Not as much.
Is that right? Okay.
Those surveys are done, I mean, the corporations do some of that surveys, those surveys in terms of what are the, obviously, you know, if you're, it's the Super Bowl, you know, you have a certain large number of people and, you know, you can watch programming and see what types of ads come on in different programming. One little story about the war on that, a lot of, you know, the first few days it was 24-hour coverage of the war. They would periodically have commercial breaks, but not very many. Well, a lot of the corporations said, we do not want to have our ads going on in the midst of all this destruction, and they pulled their ads. Mm-hmm. And so the media said, well, you know, look, here's what we'll do. It wasn't, I mean, it's not exactly like this, but what you began to see was that right before a commercial break, you would have a human interest story of women in the military, mm-hmm. you would have a little story about how does one cook and worship in Saudi Arabia, an Islamic country, as a Christian, and then now we'll hear a word from our sponsors. And then back to casualty counts or you know something else. But that the upbeat sort of human interest stories would be right before the commercial break, almost invariably, during that early coverage period. And that gets to some of the you know sort of entertainment and you know we want to feel people will be in good mood. If you're thinking about death and destruction, you're not likely to be worried about buying Pepto-Bismol or maybe that's exactly what you want to buy. Yeah.
That was a good time.
Right. Someone had a...
I just wanted to ask a question on the public definition. Is there really a difference between the white middle class and other middle class viewers?
That's a good question. And I'm not going to pretend to answer that. I think there's several answers on that. This goes way beyond just the war, but the media itself. If you look at what are the roles that you see non-whites and women and non-middle class? You know, I mean, if you want to ask a question of how many sitcoms or other things focus on as a hero or heroine a working class image or blacks or Hispanics or Asians, you know, you can look at just you know county numbers and then what sort of class background those folks. Bill Cosby show, he's a doctor. There's a lot of stuff in analyzing race and class and gender in the media, which is very important. And I don't have all the answers here. Well, I was listing various things that folks said. So I want to be, you know, we can challenge that, suggest it might be different.
How did they pick the people they call. I get, every so often I get calls on, and many of them are national things and a lot of local things on that. And I just keep wondering why they're always calling me.
Well, it's probably because they've never called me, so it averages out.
Well, they take one list of subscription people and they take the list of the things you subscribe to.
What that raises a question, which is another thing, is the amount of the media that's based on polls. And folks saw the polls of, right before the bombing started. Most of the polls said the country is pretty evenly divided, 55-45 in favor of using force, the others wanting to delay. And within 24-48 hours of the next time they could get a poll after the bombing started, it suddenly shifted to 80% or 90%. And you have to wonder, what happened? Did a bunch of people have a change of heart? And some of that has to do with the way the questions were asked. And there's been Stat Fair. And other groups have analyzed the way the questions were asked. They were asked in such a way that if you thought that military action, like the airstrikes, usually they would ask is, should we start the ground war now to end the war quickly, or should we continue the air war to soften them up a little more? Well, if you're opposed to both, what answer do you give? You have to give no opinion, which makes you sound uninformed or whatever. But in other words, the way they asked the questions in almost every case made it, skewed the weight as to what people were actually thinking.
Are a lot of these polls, are they first in person or are the responses written?
Well, they're phone surveys. Yes, almost all of these are phone surveys.
I thought that a lot of people may not, maybe reluctant to give their true thought, that they think their true thought is going to put them in the wrong categories.
No, you can't, rarely are they open-ended responses. They're usually yes, no, or strongly agree, disagree. I mean, it's some quantified set of responses.
I guess I'm saying even if they were open-ended, there are times that people are reluctant to say what they really think.
Oh, that's certainly true. The other thing is that anybody who lives at Holden on the long-term staff is excluded from these polls because it's a phone survey, so. And there's no phone here. So, in other words, if you think about who are the people in our society who don't have phones, they can't participate in this no matter what, and their opinions, and even if people aren't willing to give their opinion, someone without a phone can't give an opinion, but is factored in on the basis of the population that does have phones.
Not only that, but people that aren't home a lot. That are busy are not around to answer the phone.
Yeah, or people don't have homes. So, there's a lot of folks that are excluded here and then.
You started by saying that maybe, I don't know what definitive statement you said about it, but that a lot of people were not pleased with the way that the media covered this. But I'm just kind of thinking about things and thinking about my parents as Mr. and Mrs. Public. And I think that in order for the televisions to get these numbers that they need, that they were giving the public what they wanted, and my parents were getting what they wanted to see, and that the majority of the public did get what they wanted to see. Mm-hmm. If they got things like all the destruction that was happening when their sons and daughters were over there, they'd turn the TV off and say, "What is this? This is crazy." And so I'm just proposing that it's not only the corporate sponsors who are deciding. They are taking into consideration what the public wants, and they gave them what they wanted.
Yeah, that's a very important point. I may have been speaking more for myself personally at the beginning than generalizing it, but I think I'm going to put it just people as opposed to the public, since the public tends to be this amorphous term, but what is it that people in this country really want to hear? Or see. That raises some disturbing concerns about our society in terms of our values. And the Nintendo approach of that it was entertaining, it was far less violent than the shows that were preempted by it. You didn't see any dead bodies or whatever.
See, my thoughts are running along the same line to this extent that
what you've got up there and what you've listed ought not be surprising to anyone, because this didn't just happen. This has been going on for a decade and a half. Mm-hmm. Call it the Vietnam syndrome or whatever, but ever since the images of villagers screaming while their village burns, or the naked young girl running out of the village, you know, you didn't see any of that kind of stuff. It was, quote, sanitized. And to get to this point now, we've lived through a decade of the 80s where we basically were told always good news. There was no bad news. We didn't see this stuff that happened, even in the Panamas or Granada stuff. You just didn't see that. And I agree with her, and that's part of where my comment was coming. We're getting what we've been satisfied or content to accept and live with. And my suspicion is, until there's enough people crying, you know, out against that kind of thing, you're going to continue to get just this kind of sanitized, pretty picture, feel good, everybody's happy, we're all together in this kind of thing. And it's far from reality, that I think, no question.
Yeah. We pick out some comments over here.
Well, my comment was that I think very, very early on, the people who needed to know knew that we were doing very well, that this was a very individual case with them, where they were afraid that if that changed, so they kept, you may call it censorship, but they kept holding back, knowing that if things did not continue to go well, that the negative effect from that would be very substantial. And then in a way, you know, we're addressing a situation that's not unique, but, you know, has to be tailored from a positive, negative switch in opinion, much more than if the issue was something besides that war. You know, pick another issue, the presidential election or something like that. But from the very start, when hour after it started, you know, we knew there was going to be an air war and they weren't going to be up there. But they didn't want to say that this was going to be a short war at that point, because if it became longer, the negative effect would be much greater.
That
censorship,
what?
But you have to also say it's being careful that you don't.
There was definitely some construction, and if you watch, and the one response I would give to both, your name is?
Polly,
okay, and Bill, okay. Your two comments, which I think are very important, because it's, you know, one of the things about the media is we have to ask as consumers, what is it we want? What is it we expect? What is it we demand? But also, what is it we're given in terms of the range of options? And in December, if you go back to the footage, folks began to talk about when the war was going to start. At a point when the country was divided 50-50, according to the polls, the country's divided 50-50 as to whether we should have a war or wait, and the media is saying, asking one expert after another, when should the war start? Or when will the war start? Not if it should start. And what I want to suggest is it's a little more complex. There's an interactive approach there in terms of we, you know, John and Jane Public may want certain things that are entertaining, that make us feel good, that sort of deny something terrible going on. But there's a range of things that are available, and there is a role way in which there were certain actions by the media that were just constructing a limit of options. And so it's, I don't want to suggest that it was some sort of conspiracy, and I think that's wrong. That's not the point. But that oftentimes, you know, the media is so big and such a sort of multi-billion-dollar business that we feel, you know, as one person watching TV or 100 people watching TV, that we don't have a lot of control. And yeah, I think it's important to sort of sort out the various things here and ask both those questions. What is it the media is doing, but also then what is happening to our society? Because, you know, most of us are not in media as a career or something, but are more using it, and we should see what are ways that we can sort of change that and use it to meet our needs. Somebody back there.
I'd like to go back to your comment about the fact that what the war showed was shown instead of more violence. I mean, I'm having trouble accepting that Americans or the public
public, because the public that watches TV doesn't want to see violence, when in fact, when they show hockey games, they show the fights. When they show baseball games, they show the fights. And I mean, American has seen the biggest movie of the summer is predicted to be Terminator Part 3 or 2 or whatever. And our Rodney is nothing, I haven't seen it, but I've heard it's an hour and a half of murder in Maine. And that's going to be the big block.
Yeah, you're not responsible for that. And this is a democracy, and we don't want to feel like we're responsible for the pain and suffering.
You said the war was less.
And the movie's not real. We don't want to see bombs killing kids.
But
that's
hockey,
real.
But hockey players who stab each other with sticks and
yeah,
stab each
other.
They're getting 100,000.
They're getting a lot of money.
That's real. They don't choose to do that.
No,
yeah,
that's
you haven't elected somebody that decided to wipe out, you know, a hockey player. You know, he gets paid
well,
a lot of money to make that personal decision.
Thank you. That's a very good point. I mean, we'll sort of keep going on that debate.
I think part of this, that this is the first war that the people in the military over there got to watch TV too, so that they could see how America was responding. And so there was some playing with, we need to respond well so our troops stay up and our troops are seeing what's
and
going
did
on
they
the war.
Did they see what was going on in this country? An accurate reflection of that?
No.
Well, it was, yeah, the protests were, don't give a lot of media to that, don't give a lot of attention. You don't want to see it dissension.
In the June 10th, march or victory parade, whatever it was in New York, a journalist was arrested for trying to interview some protesters. The charges were dropped, and they said, you know, this was a restricted area, you can't be here. And he said, this is where news is happening, of course I can be here. And he was seized by the police.
Our local channels have protesters on almost daily
mm-hmm.
in Portland.
Yeah, I think it depends on where you're at, and that's where it's important to acknowledge that there are smaller stations, you know, if you look at their coverage, there is difference than this expert stuff, and that coverage was
yeah.
national news.
There
the was network
nothing on
news.
National, but the local channels had
yeah.
coverage of protests
mm-hmm.
almost daily.
Yeah.
Did any other channels in the country get the speech by Wellstone, Senator Wellstone, the new senator from
mm-hmm.
Minnesota?
Did you hear that?
During the debate?
Yeah.
I think a lot of folks did, because
yeah.
that stuff was national television.
And in Minnesota, they broadcasted in this.
Oh really?
He was absolutely against every little
yeah.
part of the war.
Well, 4 days later, he voted to support the president's position once the bombing had started. I mean, I like Wellstone too. I think he's it's extraordinary that he's in the Senate. But what's interesting is 47 senators made very eloquent speeches, and voted against the authorization of military force. And all but one of those senators, at the end of the week, voted on a resolution, which has no binding effect, to support the president in the present war. Now, if they felt as strongly as they did that sanctions should be given time to work and you should not use military force, why did they suddenly? And I don't want to blame them. I think
save their political skin.
Right. And, you know, they're in some sense. You raise the question of the relationship between politics and morality, and that's what I hope, even though we haven't said it up until now, that we're doing here is that how do we address moral issues in the media and not just things that provide a certain percentage of viewers, make us feel good, whatever. But really deal with. And in a democracy, where ostensibly diversity of opinion is good and should be valued, why is it we don't try and cover, more diversity, except for in the small? And that may be a clue. And if you look at alternative media, and I do want to make one mention of that, if you look at some of the weeklies and nonprofit radio stations, etc. There's often a greater diversity. Two things about nonprofits. National Public Radio, I'm sure how many folks listen to NPR on one of those? And PBS, folks have jokingly called PBS Petroleum Broadcasting Systems because most over 75% of their funding comes from corporations, and the largest chunk of that is from oil corporations. So, you know, when you think of nonprofit, non-commercial coverage, the same with NPR, the percentage is like 70, 80% of their funding comes from corporations. I have a friend who works for an entirely nonprofit in New York, radio station in New York, and he said, we jokingly say national public radio is sort of state radio. You know, if it's, you know, if you talk about national, even though it's much